From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. How many today believe in spirits, the supernatural, and the possibility of communication with unseen worlds? In a society increasingly characterized by computers and high technology, that question would probably embarrass many people. But it made a strange kind of sense not long ago to the Irish poet William Butler Yeats, who lived from 1865 till 1939. George Mills Harper, a scholar at the National Humanities Center, is writing about Yeats's interest in the supernatural and the poet's fascination with automatic writing. Joining in the conversation is Kent Mulliken, my colleague at the center.
Well, I presume you could trace it as far back as you'd like to go, but certainly in the latter half of the 19th century, a lot of people who were interested in spiritualism began to experiment with automatic writing. And by the time of the founding of the Society for Psychical Research in 1882, there was a considerable number of people, especially in London, who experimented with it in detail. It's not always the same. People don't always practice it the same way. As Yeats practiced it, it was very much like a seance. Yeats's wife was the medium, and she was dictated to, presumably, by a control or a supernatural spirit. And she wrote the answers down without taking her pen up from the paper until she came to the end of a line.
But is this something that just happens spontaneously? A group of people comes together and decides to communicate with another world? What's going on?
That has been practiced. But Yeats and his wife didn't practice automatic writing that way.
They were more deliberate?
In the beginning, apparently, according to Yeats, just certain sort of scattered and broken sentences came to his wife. And he felt that that had a bearing on his own personal problems.
Well, what motivated him to want to communicate with another world, with the supernatural?
Well, he didn't begin this one. He had been before. He had attended hundreds of seances in his time and was, in fact, a member of the Society for Psychical Research.
Was the interest in the supernatural greater at that time than, say, it is in the 1980s?
Yes, indeed, I think it was.
And why was that?
I think there was still a great hope that people could communicate, people of this world could communicate with people of the other world.
Did Yeats have any one figure or kind of person that he was communicating with?
No, during the automatic writing, which he conducted with his wife, there were several, but not great numbers of so-called spirits. They were he usually called them communicators, and they changed occasionally, but three or four of them did most of the communicating.
What did this do to Yeats's reputation as a poet among the people that he moved in? Did people think he was crazy, for instance, for having an interest like this?
Well, he didn't tell very many people about what he was doing. He hid it from a lot of people, including his father, who was very skeptical. And he would say the slightest of things to some of his friends, but only to a very few of the friends who were most certainly sympathetic did he say anything in detail.
What about Yeats's attitudes towards Christianity, you know, whether or not he was a practicing Christian?
Well, he wasn't a practicing Christian, but he was interested in Christianity, and Christ figures very prominently in a lot of his literature, and all the way, almost, through the automatic writing.
In what sense does he?
Well, Christ... Yeats, you may remember that Yeats had a cyclical theory of history. In effect, he thought that everything came back around in something like 2,000 years. He thought that every cycle of 2,000 years was initiated by a new Messiah or a Christ figure. And the last one, of course, was Jesus Christ. And Yeats expected another one about the turn of the 21st century. Probably as late as 2050. But Christ was the symbolic figure of the last cycle.
Now, what did the automatic writing have to do directly with Yeats's interest in such a cycle? Was he looking for answers? Was he looking for inspiration as a poet?
Long after, 12 or 13 years after they had begun to write, Yeats said that the communicators told him that they had come to give him metaphors for poetry. That phrase, incidentally, is nowhere in the writing. This may be Yeats's memory of it. But that's a way of saying, I think, that he didn't have a literal belief in everything which he wrote down. And it did furnish him metaphors for poetry. There's no doubt about that. Many poems and plays were either directly or indirectly are traceable directly or indirectly to that writing.
George, this is what other poets have called the muse. Is there anything new here?
Well, I presume that that's one fair way of saying it. It doesn't sound like the standard muse, though, because there are numerous controls or communicators.
Did the controls have names?
Yes, they did.
Identities?
They did, and they were separate. One of them would say that he could not answer a certain question, that another one would come, that sort of thing. And none of them are traceable to people we know.
In other words, they were not figures in history. They were not William Shakespeare or John Milton or...
But he had experimented with that. 3 or 4 years earlier, before this began, he had communicated with... an actual historical figure named Leo Africanus, a 15th century African historian who had spent some time in Rome. So he had experimented with that.
And what was the substance of these communications? Is there a way to summarize them?
It's not very easy to do that. A lot of the material, one portion of it, maybe a half of it, went into a book which became A Vision.
And that's the name of the book?
That's the name of the book, A Vision. On the other hand, half and maybe two-thirds of the material have nothing in the automatic writing, have nothing to do with that book. A lot of it is very personal, having to do with his friends and especially the women in his life. And that part of it is left out of A Vision.
What about the women in Yeats's life? He's beyond doubt one of the great love poets of this century. We know anyone who's read about Yeats must know about his passion for Maud Gunn. The automatic writing started after his marriage to Georgie Hyde Lees. And Richard Ellman says that perhaps one of the reasons that Yeats's new wife began the automatic writing is because of Yeats's doubts about the success of his marriage.
Well, it could be. I think it did begin in that way. In fact, for a long while I thought that was maybe nonsense, but in the last few weeks I've discovered some unpublished letters, among other things, which suggest that he thought that he had betrayed three people, he said. That was Maud Gunn, her daughter, Isolde Gunn, and his new wife, George.
When you say betrayed them, you mean what?
He felt that he had married her without loving her, as he probably should have, Georgie, and that he might even have betrayed the other two women who had refused to marry him only recently. And as a result, he said in a letter to Lady Gregory on the 29th day of October, 1917, that he was in great gloom. And while he was in this great gloom, apparently, George began to come out with these broken sentences, which are entirely about Isolde Gunn. So Isolde was certainly on his mind, and she had only recently refused to marry him.
What did the brand new science or art of psychology or psychotherapy, what did it say about all of this?
Yeats himself was interested without knowing a lot, in my opinion. Much of this material sounds as though he were well acquainted with Carl Jung, which he actually was not, apparently, but it's very Jungian in tone. He and his wife both had read some Freud, how much I don't know, But Freud is named two or three times in the automatic writing, so it's definite that they had Freud in mind. And as they talk about assault guns problems, they consistently use terminology that might be used by Freudian psychologists. They talk about her knots, for example, her complexes, and they distinguish between the unconscious and the subconscious and this sort of thing. So they were acquainted with it, and they were psychoanalyzing Ysolt, I think, who must have had considerable problems.
Has Yeats been accused of fraud?
More George, I think. I think George's wife, it was early, well, until fairly recently, nearly all critics assumed that it was merely her device for turning an unhappy husband away from his problems. I think Yeats was uncertain, and he was always, strangely enough, a kind of a half-skeptical man. He started always believing, but he never swallowed. He wasn't incredulous. I mean, he wasn't, he wouldn't believe everything that came.
You have mentioned, George, that Yeats was a very practical man, that he had a, that he wasn't a daydreamer, that he had a very earthbound sense of things.
Yes, and Yeats himself talks about his stagecraft and management of men, which he had to undertake for the Abbey Theater and all the projects that he was involved in.
It's an odd combination of characteristics here.
I think Yeats wanted to be a mystic, but he certainly wasn't. He was a very rational man pursuing irrational truths. And you may remember one of his little poems, a late poem called An Acre of Grass, in which he said, "Let me be Timon or Lear or that William Blake who beat his head against the wall till truth obeyed his call. Let me be," he said, suggesting that he knew he could not be. He was practical. He managed the affairs of the Abbey Theater for many, many years. It wouldn't have existed if it hadn't been for him. He managed the affairs of all his family except his younger brother, who married a woman with money. He was the manager. He was a very practical man about money too.
So it was the rational and the practical element that characterized his life.
I think he was perfectly logical about this automatic writing. He was skeptical, but he kept thinking there was truth in it, and he kept pursuing it very logically. One question almost always grew out of another. They're not random in this script, as they are in much automatic writing. It's a completely logical chain almost every day.
Probably Yeats would himself have no trouble reconciling the opposite tendencies in his life, because his poetry derives so much of its energy from conflicting forces and opposites, almost grabbed by the scruff of the neck and pushed together. It seems to be a characteristic of Yeats's imagination.
He had an amazingly subtle mind, I think, and he would take the greatest imaginative leaps in this automatic writing, and he would make he would find amazing profundities in what seemed like utter simplicities or utterly ridiculous statements sometimes.
But I guess this is the question that we have to raise, and I think we've been nibbling around skeptical questions, and we have to remind ourselves that when you're talking about a poet as great as Yeats, who is so far beyond us usual common mortals, we have to be reverent, but we can't help in some cases being skeptical, and we have to ask, do Yeats's poems after, say, 1920, after the automatic writing was in fairly good swing, do they derive power, and do they require a knowledge of what's in that book of vision to be read?
That's a very good question. I'll answer it in two or three parts. Three or four of his poems require a knowledge of a vision. You can't really understand the phases of the moon, for example, without exploring the book. Most of his poetry was influenced by the automatic writing and a vision. Most of the poetry thereafter, from about 1917 on, if I had time, I could point this out. On the other hand, most of it can be read without a vision. And that's almost amazing, I think. in right in the very middle of a vision of the automatic writing frequently, he will seem to get an idea for a poem. And I can tell, I know, that he stopped to write the poems which were merely suggested by something in the automatic writing of the night before, say. That's especially true of two poems that must have had their genesis on succeeding days, for example. One of them is a very well-known but very difficult poem, I think, called The Double Vision of Michael Robartes. That grew right straight out of an automatic script. George Yeats drew a diagram of a tower which represents the ruins at Cashel in South Ireland. And before the script is over that night, they talk about Cormac, and the phrase enters that poem, Cormac's Ruined Tower, which makes it perfectly clear that he's referring to George's sketch, among other things, and that poem had to grow. The next day or so, another poem grew out of it. It was called, originally, A Double Vision. Yeats had a theory that two people who were very sympathetic might dream dreams that were related symbolically. And in a vision, that theory became the complementary dream theory. He wrote a poem which we all know as Towards Break of Day as a result of their dreams and the script one night. He first titled it A Double Dream, and it's right in the middle of automatic writing. And nobody has ever seen it because no note has ever been made that that was the original title. And there it is, and right in the middle of the writing.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about the Irish poet William Butler Yeats with George Mills Harper, a scholar at the center and a professor of English at Florida State University. At the center, Professor Harper is writing a book about Yeats's interest in the supernatural and his poem entitled A Vision, which is based on some 4,000 pages of automatic script dictated to Mrs. Yeats in her role as medium. Joining in the conversation with Professor Harper is Kent Mulliken, my colleague at the National Humanities Center.
Yeats, in A Vision, puts people in cycles and categorizes them according to his very complicated system. Have you ever been tempted to figure out your own category?
No, I never tried, but people at Oxford, while he was working on this system, students around Oxford who were sympathetic to what he was doing used to do that. They apparently would meet on Monday night. Yeats always had Monday night meetings wherever he lived, and the students would come and try to put all their friends in the phases of the moon. There were 28 phases of the moon, according to his system.
Do they work like a sort of psychological categories?
They are. In one sense, A Vision is a book of basic psychology. In another one, it's a book of expounding a cyclical theory of history. And the interesting thing is, though, that Yeats, the automatic writing, has a lot of names of people who belong in certain phases who never found a place in the book when it was finally published. For example, Maud Gunn is perfectly clear in the system that Maud, in the automatic writing, that Maud belongs in phase 16, but when he wrote his book, he left her out.
Who are some of her companions in phase 16?
Blake and Beardsley. Especially.
Now, what is it that characterizes this particular phase?
Phase 16 is the best phase, you'll decide when you read all of this, is the best phase a human being can belong to. Phase 15, is perfect beauty, and there's no human life in phase 15 or phase 1.
What does all of this have to do with what's called astrology? Anything?
Well, Yeats was a kind of a minor astrologist or astrologer, and George knew something about it, and it does figure in the automatic writing. There is not much astrology in the vision, by the time it was written, they left that out. They were really pretty amateurish about this sort of thing.
What impact on the people that you've been describing did this categorization have? Did they sort of look at it and laugh at it? Did they care about it at all?
I think several of those young Oxford students, and I won't go through all of them, L.A.G. Strong was one of them, incidentally, and William Forstead, who was an American at Oxford at the time, he's the American, incidentally, who baptized T.S. Eliot. And William Forstead was frequently present, and he enjoyed this, and he really sort of believed in it, I believe. But most of them, I think, thought it was a kind of a parlor game. And in the main, I think the fascinating thing about it is how many people, as I say, to me, it's fascinating to see how many people are left out. One of the most interesting ones, I might say before I forget it, is Ezra Pound. Yeats put Ezra Pound in phase 12, which is the heroic phase, with Nietzsche. And Pound's name remained in phase 12 all the way through the Gallic proofs of the first version of A Vision and then was taken out. Yeats had said some very strong things about him in a first version, in the form of a dialogue between Robartes and Ahern, two mythical characters. And I think Yeats had decided that he had been too harsh with his friend Pound, and he took him out.
George, what is it that somebody coming to Yeats's poetry afresh, or after having not looked at it for a number of years for one reason or another, what is it that one should be aware of and look for? How do you make your way through Yeats's poetry?
Well, an ordinary reader would have much difficulty tracing the kind of information or the kind of basis, or the kind of system which we've been talking about. But any reader, I think, who enjoyed poetry would enjoy reading the love poetry. He's one of the, as Kent said, he's one of the great love poets of our time, it seems to me. And many of them, almost all of them, are written about the women in his life. And by that I mean not one or two, but many. It's common knowledge that he wrote many poems to or about Maud Gunn, but there are a good many about her daughter. There are several about his wife, and of course there are also family poems about women. And it's interesting that he should have written a poem, a prayer for his daughter, and also one for his son, but the prayer for the daughter is just a far better poem than the one for the son. He almost always wrote much better poetry when he was writing about or to women than when he was writing about or to men. Near the end of his life, for example, he wrote two series of poems, one to an old man and one to an old woman. The Crazy Jane poems are much better than the Lunatic Tom poems, and as everybody is aware. He had some kind of sympathy for the womanhood that he didn't have for manhood, I think.
What are the themes that run through William Butler Yeats's poetry? What's he concerned about?
Well, almost all the good poems. I didn't finish answering a question a little while ago. Nearly all of the best poems, to most modern critics, are poems, incidentally, which were written after he began to do this automatic writing, and especially the late poems, that is, beginning with The Tower in 1928 and The Winding Stair. The first version of that was written in 1929 and then expanded in 1933. But Yeats himself said that he put those two books in evidence that his poetry had grown in power and self-confidence. Those poems, to go back to your question, those poems are not primarily love poems, the ones we know best. They are political poems, but are rarely ever related directly to particular political events. Yeats always rose above political events, with one exception. He wrote one of the great political poems of our time about the Easter Revolution in 1916, but he didn't finish it and publish it for 6 or 8 months after the event. So, like Wordsworth, he recollected emotion in tranquility. Here is the Second Coming, which may be his best-known poem in recent times because it seems to be appropriate to political situations today. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dim tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming? Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. Now you can see how many of those lines come straight out of the automatic writing, incidentally. Those late ones, though, are oftentimes about political events in the broadest possible universal sense. Yeats thought that for one reason or another, and for many reasons, that the world was in, Western civilization was in a decline. The decline and fall of this foul world was very real to him. And many of the poems reflect this. For example, 1919, for example, which is a very powerful poem, I think. The Tower, for example, the title poem of that volume. And even many of the shorter, later poems reflect it in one way or another. And he could also manage to talk about civilization at the same time that he wrote love poems of a strange kind. The Crazy Jane poems are poems which emphasize the needs of the body in contrast to the soul.
If I stepped off a spaceship from Mars, and I've got to get back, I haven't got much time, but would you read for me the best five poems of W.B. Yeats? What would those five be?
Well, if I had to pick out the ones that I wanted to be certain to concentrate on, I would say it would have to take one of the very popular ones these days, The Second Coming, A Prayer for My Daughter, 1919. Maybe The Tower, which is really a series of poems, but one poem in the very real sense. And then, despite the bad things that have sometimes been said about it, I'm very fond of the one he wanted to appear last, and that's Under Ben Bulbin. It, too, is a series of interrelated poems, but it has an awful lot about Yeats's thoughts about civilization in it.
George Mills Harper is a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of English at Florida State University. At the center, Professor Harper is writing a book on William Butler Yeats's poem, A Vision. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to join me this week for Soundings. My guest will be George Mills Harper, a scholar at the National Humanities Center, who's an authority on William Butler Yeats, the Irish poet. Professor Harper will discuss Yeats's interest in mysticism and the occult, and particularly the poet's fascination with automatic writing. That's Authors in Eternity, a conversation about William Butler Yeats, this week on Soundings.